Richard Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Richard Skipper celebrates the best in entertainment. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique, never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Wednesday, everyone, and welcome to Richard Skipper Celebrates. For those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. My show is all about celebrating life, celebrating art, celebrating artists. What makes a great artist? How do they get from point A to point B and beyond? Well, today you're going to find out because we have an amazing artist waiting in the wings. But before we get to her, I want to talk about some of the things that are being celebrated today. Believe it or not, there is a page called Check-A-Day, and there are all kinds of sometimes odd holidays. Did you know that today is National Checkup Day, Medical Checkup Day? So if you haven't had a medical checkup lately, today is the day to put that on your calendar. It's the time to get out there and get that done. It's also Play in the Sandbox Day or Play in the Sand Day. And I can't think of a better place to play in the sand than the Goodspeed Opera House, which is always worth celebrating. And there's a reason why we're going to celebrate the Goodspeed Opera House, because right now there's a wonderful show playing there called Little Girl Blue, the Nina Simone story. And it's starting the incredible Leona Michelle. And she is our special guest today, and she is always worth celebrating. Don't believe me? Take a little glimpse, and you'll meet her on the other side. And here she is, Leona Michelle. Look at you, looking so relaxed, laying back, when you've got so much on your platter today. First of all, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know that you are incredibly busy right now, so the fact that you're spending an hour with me today means the world to me. I want to ask you, in the midst of everything else that's going on right now, what are you celebrating?
I am celebrating life every day, every single day, with my family. I just feel like being alive is a gift. It's a gift to be healthy, Mm-hmm. My brother right now is suffering from bone cancer. I came home to spend these couple of days with him and just like cocoon with him a bit, you know, and love on him. And every day he's celebrating life.
And what's his name? What's his name?
His name is Ahmad.
So Ahmad, we celebrate you today. Get better soon.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. And I must say that doing this show, Little Girl Blue, this is like a food medicine for my soul. Like it just feels so good to dive into the arts and, you know, live, nest with Nina and groove with her. You know, she has a way of just getting it all out, out of my system. And I know it certainly for the audience as well. We're just in an experience that is just so sacred.
I'm such a huge fan of Nina Simone. I have spent the entire morning this morning just listening to her on my device. I won't mention her name because she'll go off right on me right now. But I've been listening to her all morning. Her music gets into your soul on so many visceral levels. And I want to talk about how she really got into your soul in a few moments. But I want to go back to the beginning. You're originally from Springfield, Massachusetts. I want to talk a little bit about your childhood. I always like to go back to the five-year-old self, because to me, the five-year-old self is that innocent self. It's the time before peer pressure gets added on, before you start becoming the child that other kids want you to be, teachers want you to be or not be. What was your life like at 5 years old growing up in Springfield, Massachusetts?
I have a big old Jamaican family with a lot of love. I wasn't surrounded by the arts, but it was very clear that I was drawn to it. Certainly in church, I was the one in the choir stand insisting that the choir has routines.
Good for you.
Sing it. You got it. Yeah, have moves. But then I also grew up in Catholic schools, and so I've been very most of my educational experiences, I've been like one of maybe two or three Blacks inside of a classroom setting. So I often felt like, okay, there's me and there's my peers, and then there's me. I always recognize the difference, you know, and I always felt the difference. Not that it was heavy-handed, but I always felt it and I recognized it. I was lucky to go to Alabama State University and HBCU when I did not get accepted into my dream school, Juilliard, and just, you know, that killed me.
Well, I will tell you something. You know, I have a very dear friend and he says rejection is God's protection. And there's a reason. Now, don't you love that? And you know, I believe that when things happen, there's a reason why they happen.
That's right. That's true. Because I got the mentor of my life, Tonia Stewart, who groomed me. And then she pushed me on to Brandeis University for grad school when they came knocking at our university's door looking for a Black male, and they got me.
Well, you know, I want to step back for a moment. I mean, you're singing in the choir. I mean, you and Ahmad, were there any other brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have. My sister also. My sister, she transitioned a couple of years ago, and her name is Destiny. Yeah, thank you. It's been a rough last 4 or 5 years of my family's life with like just sickness and illness, but we've all been so resilient through it all, and I've been like tremendously blessed, not to go too far off of your question, but my sister gifted me with her 5-year-old son, so I am a mom now as well. Raising Rohan. But yeah.
Now, are you finding with Rohan that you're seeing any artistic side to him? Is he, you know, pursuing a career?
Oh, yeah. My sister was a point ballerina and he loves to dance. He's very sensitive. He loves to dance. So I am definitely staying on top of him with that. When I was younger, my mother put me in piano lessons, and that was about it as far as like being artistic, but I just was not disciplined. I think I only made it past maybe the third book. mom, did you not see that I would be playing Nina Simone? I needed more scales.
Well, you know, what was the pivotal point in your life when you said, I want to do this as a career, I want to pursue this?
Oh boy, I remember it so specifically, and I've been like trying to track down this show. It was when I was about 11, 12 years old, and I saw a production of Romeo and Juliet, and the Romeo came on stage, and it was this beautiful Black man, and he was the only Black person in the show, and it was one of those performances where schools are all invited, And I was just, the lights fell to dark, you know, the blackness came. And when he walked out on the stage and he started to speak, I was so taken. I just did not know we could sound like that. We could talk like that. His eloquence, his grace, his being the leading man. I was just, it shook me. It stirred me. And I began reading lots of Shakespeare plays and directing my friends in the neighborhood, and even bringing some of that to the church as well. But yeah, I'll always remember that. And I think every kid who's, you know, in the arts, something happens young, like when you're really young, that you get a little taste of it, or you just see it, and that mm-hmm. light bulb moment happens, and you can't take it away from that. You just, you can never go back. You just, everything compares to that.
And you know? Did you go home that day and tell your mom about the experience that you felt?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. I did. And she did her best. She found some like dance schools, but that's not what I was looking for. You know, I was an
actress. How long after seeing Romeo and Juliet did you have your own experience of being on stage? And I'm sure there's some little boy and girl in the audience who was seeing you on stage and having the same experience.
There was a tour that came through our hometown of Springfield, Dream Girls. And they happened to have an open call audition. And I begged my mom if I could just audition. And I got into the show and I was in the ensemble and understudying two of the Dream Girls. And I was 16 at that time. And the show left our city and went to tour. Mom was like, nope, you're staying here. And it was crushing. I just thought I was, you know, packing my bags and I was going to be off with this tour.
So you didn't go?
I did not go on a tour. I only performed in the city of Springfield.
Okay.
Yeah, she only let me do it here. I mean, I understand now. But it was even just being here, being able to perform in front of my peers, my family, my community, and the level of support I got from my hometown of Springfield, really compelled me to want to pour back the arts into this city mm-hmm. That I'm sitting in right now, my mom's sofa. I started a camp years later for children.
Now, where are you right now?
I'm in Springfield, Massachusetts right
now. Oh, you're back there. Okay.
Yep. It's about an hour and 10 minutes from Goodspeed. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to come home and check on
family. I performed in Springfield. There used to be a place, I don't know if it's still there, called the Log Cabin. Is that still there?
Cabin. Don't know.
It was 150 years ago. So I have been to Springfield, so I know.
Yes.
So at what point eventually you made your way to New York? Was it a show that got you to New York, or did you get a show after you came to New York?
After grad school, we had a showcase in New York, and I ended up getting an agent. Yeah, and then from there, there was like a long period of time where I didn't have any work. You know, I was still very green at the time. My experience at grad school was just so tremendous, even though I was the one Black student there, you know, I was like their leading lady. So you can only imagine coming from grad school and landing in New York and like, no, there is no space. There's no room here. And my agent at the time said, you better start singing, girl. And I was like, well, I know how to sing, but I really wanted to do Shakespeare. You know, I wanted to be doing the straight dramas. So I sang in his office. And then from there, my resume just became like so like full with just musical. And I did end up doing very little Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
So to make a long story short, I complained a lot about the material that I was given. And he kept saying to me, well, why don't you write your own show? Why don't you write your own show?
You know? Before we get there, mm-hmm. your agent, do you feel that he was very, and is your agent still the same agent?
He is now my manager.
Oh, he's your manager. Great.
Yeah.
And was at that point, was he very proactive in terms of trying to get you work? He was against the odds. I mean, we have been dealing in the last few years, the last year, I guess, more so than ever, with doors opening for diversity.
Right.
If you can address those issues from your point of view, of those doors and being pigeonholed, you want to be a Shakespearean actress. You are a Shakespearean actress. But no one else is seeing you as a Shakespearean actress because of, as they say in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, a pigmentation problem. That is not really a problem except in the eyes of other people.
You know, isn't it such an old story though? I mean, like really, it's just that the whole thing is just so, I've been talking about this for so long that, you know, it's quite frankly, now we're addressing it, like it, to some degree is being addressed in a way where the needle was going too far. Like, okay, so now we're just going to go all black here. Oh, we're going to go all the way here. But no one ever said that. It's not about this way or that way. It's about, you know, finding a balance and making a room and across the board in everything. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. No one said, you know, get rid of all your white designers. No one ever said that, you know. But what we are saying is that, you know, too often I step to the plate of a show, and it'll be a show that's a black piece, but it's not written by a black person. It's a black story, right? And to me, that's the problem so mm-hmm. often, that oftentimes our stories are not told by us, you know, but mm-hmm. we're the poster child of it. And also directed by the people who are not, don't look like me, or designed by people who don't look like me. And it's, and I have so many friends who have studied who, and I mean, this, you know, my designer, he Devanand Janki, he's Indian, and one of the things he said to me,
I have had him sitting in the same seat that you're sitting in right now.
So wonderful, isn't he?
I love him. He's been on the show. I love him.
He is adorable. He's the best. He is mm-hmm. the best. And he said to me yesterday, he said, Leona, our last show on Sunday, I was a bucket of tears. He said this Indian couple came up to him and said, we're here because we saw that there was an Indian director and we wanted to see what this was all about. And so it becomes bigger than us because inclusion does matter. Representation mm-hmm. does matter. And we've been calling for stories like this since the beginning of time, you know, mm-hmm. and to my manager's credit, yeah, we do got to step up to the plate and write it, you know, and not get tired of being told no and push the envelope, you know, because the truth be told, I mean, if we want to get really plain, you know, a black person could have never directed the Schindler's List, you know, it just would never go down, you know, mm-hmm. but a white director can direct The Color Purple, something that's so rich in black culture and Southern roots and, you know, the blood of the earth and all of those mm-hmm. things that speak such and resonate so true to me. And nonetheless, it was directed beautifully. But I guess my point is that I just feel like we need to be asking the questions why, you know, and because if you can't answer those questions, is the why because you don't know the directors? Because I know a lot of them. I know a lot of designers. I know, you know, a lot of creatives, you know. So I just think it's a lazy industry, pretty much.
Exactly. It amazes me in an industry that is all about inclusion, that there is so much exclusion. It's so interesting. I watched a documentary the other night on Rita Moreno. And mm-hmm. after she did West Side Story, for which she wins an Academy Award, she couldn't get work for 2 years because every role that they wanted her to play was a stereotype.
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
And you know what I say to that? When I wrote this show, Little Girl Blue, this is my Shakespeare. This is my heightened language. This is my grace. This is my musical. I'm tapping into everything. This is all the three, four years of musical lessons that I've had. All of it. It's in here. You know, all of my passion is in here. And so it's just.
It's well, had you ever written anything prior to writing this?
Right. Prior to this, I wrote a number of children plays. So my camp that I started here in Springfield, Shakers Performing Arts Camp, which was the inner city hip hop Shakespeare camp, that did very well. And then it kind of outgrew the Boys and Girls Club where it started. So my family, we came together and we created a studio here called Dream Studios, mm-hmm. where now they teach, you know, all types of art to inner city kids. Oh my God, I lost your question. I'm sorry. What was it? What was
the I asked if this was the first time. if you had written
the place.
Okay.
Yeah, so I was writing all the original musicals for our summer camps and our plays there. But yeah, Little Girl Blue is the first big stab at something that is hitting the big stage. And my other show that I'm working on now is the Nelson Mandela musical.
Yes,
you know, that's right. Very exciting, you know, to be sandwiched in between Nina and Nelson is just tremendous responsibility there with my collaborators, Greg and Sean Borowski, Borowski brothers.
That's wonderful.
It's exciting.
I want to talk about your process. I want to dissect Little Girl Blue, if you will. I want to first of all go back. When did the light bulb go off for you when you said, "I want to tell this story," and to tell it through your eyes, and of course to tell Nina's story?
Well, it the light bulb kept, it was a little light, and then it kept getting more intense as, you know, time went on. And what I mean by that is that Nina kept coming to me. She just kept showing up in my life. Like, I was meeting family members. I was, people kept telling me, "You sound like Nina. Oh, you look like Nina. Oh, are you going in for this, Nina?" Or roles started getting offered to me to play Nina. And I knew who she was and grew up with albums in the house and the music. But really what called me to her was my own personal frustration, you know, my own personal blows that I was taking mm-hmm. as an artist. You know, I identified with her. And so I began to just immerse myself in just reading everything, all things Nina, you know, studying her images. And before I knew it, the script started writing itself. And it just became from a collection of stuff all around my office, all things Nina, you know. And eventually I said, okay, I don't even know if I have anything here, but let me try to organize it a bit. And I had one of my girlfriends, who's an amazing actress, just read it back to me, you know, so I could see how it rolled over me, you know, the mess of what I had. And she and I pretty much recognized that it was worth trying to figure it out. And she deserves it. You know, she really does deserve it to be on the biggest platforms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'll certainly say.
Can you tell us a little bit about the evening? Does it take place on a specific night in Nina's life? Mm-hmm. Is it an arc of her life? Tell us about the evening itself.
Okay, so I like to describe this piece as a theatrical, immersive experience. And I start there because for me and the three band members on stage, you know,
your bass player is one of my long-term bass players, Saadi Zane. So give a big shout out to Saadi from me.
He's incredible.
Yes.
He's incredible. Incredible. And I knew we needed to have like only the best musicians. These guys, they have to sing and act, you know, mm-hmm. and they believe in the message so much so that they've stepped all the way up to the plate with it, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and thank God we were able to keep the same team together. But we are experiencing it in such a rich way that once we step on that stage, there is just no acting. There just can't be. There can't be room for skill anymore. It has to be room for, okay, these people here, this particular audience who are stepping into this space with us, we got to give them the real experience. So there's a freedom in it, in that. It's kind of like a call and response. Like when you go to church, you know, you fall into that with the congregation. Mm-hmm. And it lifts off based on the energy that's in the space, right? So it's very, it's exciting, and it's a little bit scary walking into that, you know, because you never know where it's going to go. And as you know, musical theater, there's so many beats and marks and things you have to hit with structure, you know. So it's been a lesson in trust, you know. And I think the audience gets it pretty much immediately, too. With the way we devised it, the way it's devised, that they just jump on board and they know that they're a part of it and they're called to respond.
And how long did it take
place?
Mm-hmm. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. Act one is in 68 in America. And then we go to 78, about a decade later, you meet Nina and you, in her evolution in act two, where now she's in Switzerland and she's very liberated. Yeah,
good for you. How long did it take you to write this piece?
From research to stage, I will say about 10 years from research to stage.
Wow.
But from like first draft, maybe about 7 years. It's been about 3 strong years of just pure research and bit slices of stories. Slices of pieces.
And can you tell us a little bit about your research and how you went about researching her life? And what did you learn about Nina that surprised you the most, that most of us probably did not know?
What surprised me the most was, well, I always knew she was very transparent. Like researching her, you'll find like Nina talks about it all. I mean, she talks about all her heartbreaks, her abuse, and she talks about it so candidly, and her being bipolar, her mental illness, her struggles with her family, her money issues, and you look at someone like Nina, who's just so, you know, hard, and to note that she actually went, you know, being physically abused and mentally abused and stayed in a relationship that was toxic. And then still can get out there on the front line with Dr. King and fight for her people. You know, to me, that's very complex, you know. But I think the thing that really surprised me the most was I knew she loved Bach, but I didn't know she loved Bach. Like Johann Sebastian Bach, the classical music for her was her biggest heartbreak. It destroyed her. It killed her. You know, when you think about all the things, like we struggled with when we were crafting the story, you know, you feel like, okay, you know, when you're making a musical, it ebbs and flows, right? You're thinking, okay, where is the climax? Where do we fall? And where do we, you know, sail? And to have all these blows that she's taking and to know that, okay, we've seen her lose a baby. We've seen her, you know, all this horrible stuff happen to her, you know, be diagnosed with bipolar. We've seen her lose her musical gift. And to know that it was her losing her skills from taking medication for her mental illness that was her biggest downfall. All she really wanted was to be known as the first Black classical pianist and play at Carnegie Hall. That's it. That is it. She never signed up to be the civil rights activist. She was called to that. You know, that was her duty to just do the work, you know. But if she had it her way, she'd be sitting pretty playing Bach all day long. You know, she just wanted to go to Curtis Institute and that gave her the most joy, the most joy.
And well, I can imagine. That, no, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just find that it's so interesting to me, you know, they're so worlds apart, you know, and I identify with that too. Like for me, when I talk about Shakespeare, sometimes it feels very worlds apart for me as well. And to be drawn to something. So I get it, you know, I get what that is. And, And that's the beautiful thing about art, you know?
And after you had, I mean, when did you know that it was time to, if you will, give birth to this? I know that you debuted this show originally at the St. George Theater in Staten Island. In New Jersey, I'm sorry. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But how long after writing this show did it take before it was on its feet in front of an audience?
Well, it was really on a fast track. Because when I say it took me 10 years to put it together, that was 10 years of me like holding my cards close to me, right? But I'll say the very first time I put Act One up on its feet was at a showcase in New York City. And for just a small crowd. And that was like 2 years before it was on the actual stage. And then like later on that year, I did just Act Two, just to like show a little bit of it. And by the time I did it all together, by that third showcase, George Street and a number of theaters were there. And the next morning, David Saint from the George Street Playhouse said, I want to give you a slot. And I was like, whoa, you know, because we've only been like showing it out loud for like a year. So it was quite aggressive. And from there, we've been chasing the train ever since. Like, we got to keep up with this. So the show has gone up. The show is headed to Off Broadway now. You know, it's some exciting things happening for it. Yeah.
And of course, a little thing called COVID came away. This past year and a half, what was your schedule like when COVID hit? Was this, you know, was it already planned to go to a good speed? Where were you in the scheme of things?
Donna Lynn reached out to us. I was in the scheme of like trying to find a lead producer, and I found one. Rashad B. Chambers, an incredible young man, to take on the show. And so we started just, you know, using this COVID time to figure out how to get the show to New York. But he was so wise. He said, well, why don't we try one more out of town? Because, you know, you only get one shot in New York City, right? And we didn't want to drink all the Kool-Aid from George Street Playhouse and, woo, it was so great. You know, we got nominated for 11 Broadway World Awards and sold out, broke all their box office records, single tickets, diversified their theater. And now I'm the artistic associate there. Which I love.
Good for you.
Yeah. So, which basically means that my job duties are to, you know, diversify the audience, audience development, new programming, making sure our designers, there's inclusion across the board, and I'm happy to do it.
That's incredible.
I got the right girls.
Let's talk a little bit about Good Speed Opera House, because I have to say it's one of my favorite theaters in the world. Kudos to the entire team. I have yet to see ever a show there that didn't blow me away. I love that theater. I love the theme. The entire team. You've performed there before, so... tell us about your first experience at Goodspeed and what it is that you love about this theater.
Wow. Oh, my goodness. What a rich history there, huh? And I applaud them for diving in and being so responsible with having this outdoor space and continuing to do theater. You know, I think Donna Lynn is doing a terrific job. She's so patient and kind. I was introduced to the Good Speed as a performer during Amazing Grace many years ago. Christopher Smith is the writer of Amazing Grace, and I was a co-star. I played a
I think I lost you. Unfortunately, she's disappeared, which sometimes happens. That's what happens with the live interview. Leona, if you can hear me, just close out and come back in. I'm going to, you know, hopefully she'll come back. In the meantime, I'm going to just... just come back in. I mean, enter back in again. just as you did before. Just to let everyone know, we are talking about Little Girl Blue, the Nina Simone musical. It opened on August 4th at the Goodspeed Opera House. It is being done outdoors, and it will be playing through the end of the month. It is celebrating the wonderful music of Nina Simone. I'm a huge fan of Nina Simone. As I was saying earlier, I was listening to her music all this morning. I hope that she's going to be able to come back. We'll see what happens. It's live theater. And here she is.
I'm so sorry.
You just... Well, it's a live program. It happens. So you were telling us about Amazing Grace and your first time at the theater.
Yes. So this is important. So I do want to say this. Christopher Smith, the writer of Amazing Grace, the John Newton story, inspired me so. He was a policeman. I don't know if you did an interview with him.
No, not
yet. Amazing Grace was there. It was many years ago. And a policeman retired. And he pretty much went around New York City knocking on doors and shopping his script under his wing to different producers. And our producer picked it up and brought it to Goodspeed. And when I heard his story, I was just so taken that someone who hasn't even studied in our industry could sit down, write a musical, and have the balls to knock on doors and believe it. I mean, lyrics, he was just doing it, you know? And I was just so impressed by that. And he was also very open. The character I played was Ayotunde, an enslaved woman from Sierra Leone. And he was so open to allowing me to come to the table to say, you know, I have some thoughts about this. And knowing that that wasn't his culture, to be still lean in and go, oh, wow, I didn't think about it like that. So the table was very collaborative. And I was drawn to how writers and collaborators work. And that really turned me on as a creator myself. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted, at that moment, I knew I wanted to be on the other side of the table. Yeah.
Now, was this the show that brought you to Broadway?
It was.
Yeah,
it was.
And what was that experience like, your first night on a Broadway stage?
It was so incredible. I had so much support, you know. It had been a long time coming. I always had a dream to be on Broadway. And here I was on the Broadway stage, you know, taking my first bow, you know. And and I always say to my students, it's so not overrated. You know, people like to say it's overrated Broadway. No, actually it's not. It's quite exciting to go off stage and then go, you know, meet the audience and sign autographs and talk to folks and do interviews. I love every piece of this industry. I really do.
And you know, I appreciate I do too. Absolutely. I love this business. I've been on every side of the business you could be in, and I just absolutely love it. What was the show that got you your equity card?
That was that.
You're muted.
I was Cordelia at the New Repertory Theater in.
We missed the title. Your voice went out.
I'm sorry.
What was the show
King
you got?
Lear.
Your okay.
King
Shakespeare.
Lear. It was Shakespeare. Yes. And I played Cordelia. And my King Lear was Austin Pendleton.
Oh my God!
Can you imagine?
I love it. I just absolutely love it. Well, I want to ask
you. It was awesome having
him
as a dad.
Growing up in Springfield.
Talking about colorblind casting.
Exactly. Well, growing up in Springfield, Massachusetts, did you know what an equity card was? When did you first become aware of an equity card? And when did it become a desire to have one?
Oh, boy. I did not know what it was at all. I did not know what it was. And in fact, it's so funny because I didn't even understand what a production contract was. You know, I was so young stepping into this industry. I remember going to an audition, in fact, and I had already had some summer stock lined up. And I auditioned for like a very major casting office who saw me in something. And they offered me a job on the spot. And I said, oh, it starts then. No, I'm not going to be able to do it. It's like a summer stock. And da, da, da. They said, well, it's a production contract. I'm like, yeah, I think it conflicts. And, da, da, da. And my friends, we laugh at that story today. You know, that probably would have been my Broadway debut at 21, you know, in my young self. But yeah, so that getting that sting was when I started to say, well, I got to figure out, how does this business really work? It's like, how does it work? Like, how do you do it? You don't just audition. You got to know stuff. You got to know contracts. You got to know, you know, and it just, I had to wake up to it. I really did. So yeah, when my equity card was offered me, I just snatched it up immediately. I wasn't thinking about points.
Wow. Yeah. Now, I want to get back to Nina, because I can only imagine, because with every single song that she sang, it became not a 3-act play, but a 5-act play. And I can only imagine the intensity with each song that you have to put in the show. What is your preparation like? How do you prepare each day before going on each night to do your show?
Oh, yeah. Because I'm the writer of it, I'm coming out of a show leads into the next show. So I'm always going through the notes of what worked, what didn't work, how to finesse. And I just don't leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And I try to be thoughtful in that way, because so much of it I can't really remember, because I'm hypnotized with it as well. I'm Nina cast her spell over all of us. So I just love the fact that I have a great director. But my warm up normally looks like physically warming up my fingers, you know, just getting them really ready. A very long warm up in my body, my foot. I'm having a foot issue these days, so just getting, because she has a very specific walk. Just getting my spine in line, my alignment. I don't eat before the show. I do a vocal warm up, but my vocal warm up really is more about articulation, because I have so much story to tell. Mm-hmm. You know? And I try not to over vocal warm up Nina, because a part of me enjoys the gravel of my voice, the texture of Nina's voice, and allowing it to like live there naturally. Mm-hmm. So I'm just trying to just really just get as close to the truth of let that be my way in as I step into her shoes every night. So I think with each show that you do as an artist, the warm up is designed around what it is that you're called to do, you know? So, yeah. So that's what my warm up pretty much looks like for Nina.
And what's your cool down like? How do you bring it down after the show?
Do you sing?
Yes, I do.
You do? Come on, cool down. You know what? You know what I found is that I like to suck on ice and hum on some ice. I love me some ice chips.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really feel like it helps the voice, just it shocks it a little bit, like it just shocks the throat, and it just feels good, or a popsicle or something, right? And then I'll just try to go on pure vocal rest to like the next day, to like maybe after. I don't start talking until like 11 o'clock in the morning. That's why my phone is trying to, like, everybody knows, do not call me. Do not call me. I will not be answering until after 11. I like to gradually let the voice wake up, you know, mm-hmm. before I have to drink water before I even say one word. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One word. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm really not that disciplined when it comes. Like, I still drink milk. I have my wine. I have my whiskey. Yeah. I, I, I wouldn't say that I'm like hardcore, you know.
How much of Nina Simone is like you?
I think we're similar in a lot of ways. Yeah, I think we're similar in a lot of ways. I think Nina is, she's very sensitive. I think she's also she's a perfectionist. Mm-hmm. I think to a fault too, like, you know, being a workaholic, it's when you work at such a high level, it's frustrating if the folks who are coming along with you are not there, right? And mm-hmm. I'm not saying that about this show at all. But I've been in shows before where folks have said, I might be saying too much, oh, she's acting like a diva or something like that. But the truth of the matter is when I'm in the show and I'm getting ready for the character, I don't like to be talked to. There's certain things that I just don't like. The fooling around backstage, all of that. In my band is the guys in my band, they're so great. They're so locked in. Even more so than, you know, actors that I have performed with, you know, that are highly trained, skilled actors. Mm-hmm. There's a respect that these musicians have, a discipline that they already come into the room with, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that they walk in there, they're already warming up and they're becoming one with their instrument. And I love that about them. I love working with musicians and I think they're doing a terrific job with their discipline. Yeah.
Is there a moment in the process as you're prepping to go on where you go, Nina goes, get out of the way, Leona, I'm here. And she takes over.
Yes. Yes. That moment is when I put on the shoes, the moment, like when I'm putting on my makeup, I'm gradually becoming, right? And the shoes are always the last thing I put on my feet in the show. By the time I step into those shoes, I feel like I'm stepping into a new world with this character, right? I don't like anyone to touch my shoes. I just like them to just, I feel like the shoes are a very sacred thing, you know, because it's your earth, right? It's your balance. It's your, how sprite you are, how the weight you bring onto the stage, all of that. And so it immediately energizes me into who Nina is. And I'll go through droves of shoes before I find the right shoe that feels like this is Nina. This feels like her. It's mm-hmm. how she walks to the piano. It's how she sits, her posture, all of that is so important. And to me, it starts with your feet, you know. I do a lot of feet, my massaging treatments, you know, I just think that's really important to have your spine right for the character. Get the spine together.
It's great to say that because it's all about grounding. It's just grounding yes. yourself. You know, I appreciate you saying that. So you started out at St. George. You're now at Church Street. Yes, and you were there now through the 29th of August. Is there any possibility of an extension or is everything very tight at Goodspeed? And is
my
there
goodness, yeah, they're just starting to be some conversations are starting to bubble around it, possibly adding a show since the tickets are now really starting to take off.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very exciting, and we knew that it would happen. So we're just grateful to it. When do you plan to come to the show?
I'm going to do everything in my power to get up there. I've already, you know, talked with Alyssa and I'm going to try to get there sooner rather than later. So an elbow bump or something, you know, after the show. So we'll wave to each other. Are you able to talk or would you prefer not to? And I respect it if you don't, about the next step with the show. I'm very respectful of not jinxing anything. Off-Broadway is being discussed. Mm-hmm. Are you able to talk about that at all?
I could talk a bit about it. I will say that we saw, I've had a chance over these few days to walk through some spaces, some theater spaces, which is very exciting. And it's just like so great to see like all the houses starting to, you know, the lights starting to come on, and knowing that I'm going to be right in that cocoon of all those Broadway shows sandwiched there with this in next year, early February is what we're looking at for opening on, or I think a previewing on Nina's birthday, which is February 21st. And that's the goal now, here.
Nina, doesn't she have a brother?
She does.
Is he familiar with the project? And have you been able to?
I have met him. We talked a little bit, but I don't know how familiar. You know, I'm sure he's familiar because Nina's grandson came to the show. Loved it. And now he and I are really, really great friends. He's definitely told his mother about it, and then I got a chance to meet her brother Sam, who also was a performer. Mm-hmm. Very nice man. And who else? And Nina's closest Al Shackman, who played for her, one of the characters in our show, reached out to our band members, and they got a chance to meet him and kind of, you know, talk about the show. And so we're hoping that he'll get to come out to good speed and have this experience.
That's wonderful. So what, I mean, where would you like to see this show? And I know that you're also working on the Mandela musical, but where would you like to see this particular show, let's say 5 years from now?
Okay, so next year off Broadway, right?
and I want to be there opening night. Doing the red carpet interviews.
All the red carpet interviews.
Yes.
Make it to the big Broadway, because this show is, it's so ready for the big Broadway. And then I think the show would tour well. I think it would probably, I would love to pass a torch on to a number of very talented women that I think would be great Ninas, you know, and to see the life of it, to go off on like a tour around the United States and probably abroad. Yeah. Like Canada would be really interesting to take it there. Right.
That's wonderful. And what do you hope that audiences come away with when they leave the theater after they have experienced your celebration of Nina Simone?
Okay, so I want them to walk away with a wider view of the world at large. And what I mean by that is I want each person who sits in this audience to be curious about their neighbor, to be curious about people who don't look like them, to be curious about the folks who live on the other sides of the tracks. I want people to be really curious and really seek out ways to getting to know each other better, a clearer understanding, really. I think that's what Nina, you know, we talk about inclusion, you know, when I set out to write this show, really it was to quiet all those voices around her, because she, you know, they always wanted to call her the angry Black woman. And so I wanted to like answer those questions, and why was she so angry, you know, and quiet that, all of that loud noise around her. And in doing so, I want people to walk away with like, you know what, I learned something here. I get it now. Mm-hmm. I understand what that is now, because I have a bit of that. You know, so there's a sensitivity that comes with that.
Who were her true friends?
Oh, she had so many. She adored Dr. King. She loved Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote A Raisin in the Sun. Mm-hmm. And she later took Lorraine Hansberry's words and made To Be Young, Gifted, and Black into a song when she passed away. She's had such rich relationships. Makeba was one of her dearest friends from South Africa, Mary Makeba. Her daughter talks about how when she grew up, sometimes walking into the kitchen and seeing like Betty Shabazz sitting at the table having tea, you know. So she's been in circles with great intellectuals, you know. And Nina was quite an intellectual herself. They were always grappling about how to make it better for their people. Like, that was the conversation. James Baldwin was one of her dearest friends. You know, they spent hours favorites. Just like talking about it, dissecting it all, you know.
And that should be the goal for each and every single person on this planet.
Yeah.
For all of us. All of us. Well, I can't believe this. We are at the end of our show. I told you before we started, my goal was at the end of this that we would be great friends.
We are so great friends.
I could talk to you for hours. Don't go anywhere. I want to thank everybody for being here. It means the world to me that you decided to spend an hour with us. I want to thank you. If this is your first time here, my hope and my goal is that you will subscribe to Richard Skipper Celebrates here on YouTube. As I said at the top of my show, I'm all about celebrating artists of all walks of life. Look at the ones that I've already celebrated and the ones that are coming up. Like Leona, it was a great experience today to do this. I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything in return. Go to your Facebook friends list, and the second name that pops up, reach out with a phone call. Not an email message, not a text message, not a private inbox message, a phone call, and let that person know what they mean to you. As a dear friend of mine, David Friedman, always says, we're all in this together. We're not in the same boat. And I always say, if you're going to go out in a boat, make sure that you bring a skipper along. Now, Leona, I want to thank you for the gifts that you've given to the world and that you're going to continue to give. I'm actually going to leave the screen and I'm going to give you the final word. Anything that you want to say about anything that we talked about today that you want to build upon, anything that we didn't talk about today that you wish that we had, or just any message that you want to put out to anyone who's watching today. I want to remind everyone that Little Girl Blue, the Nina Simone musical, will be playing at the Goodspeed Opera House right now through August 29th. The ticket information will be in the body of the information that will be on YouTube. So check it out. Go see this musical and not only support this show at the Goodspeed Opera House, support the other shows that they're doing, and let's keep live theater live. Thank you all for being here. And now I'm going to give you the final word. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Richard. I really appreciate this short period of time that we got to share together. This was incredible. And as I said before, I love everything about this industry. And there's nothing I enjoy more than live theater. And I'm so grateful to be back on stage before a live audience. Nina Simone once said, an artist's duty is to reflect the times. And we are in some very interesting times in our lives. And this is the right time for all of us to be better human beings, kinder to each other. And I'm going to take your advice and I'm going to make that call. I'm going to make a few calls. Life is too short and we got to spread the love. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it. God bless you all.